Hello, everyone. This is Lucy and Erica, and we're coming on to tell you about our sources for part one and part two of the Bob Crane episode that I read a book called Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography. It was written by Carol M. Ford, D. Young, and Linda J. Groundwater. If you are interested at all about Bob Crane and his life, literally, I just scratched the surface of the book. I mean, it's a ginormous book. They put in so much work and effort. You can also borrow it for free on Amazon Kindle Unlimited. So if you have that. So Carol M. Ford, who is one of the authors, has two podcasts about Bob Crane. One's The True Story of Bob Crane and Hogan's Heroes Review. So if you're interested even more about Bob Crane and want to learn more, give those a listen as well.
Yeah, and the other sources that were very helpful to me was a couple of local Phoenix news stations, because that's where it occurred in Arizona. I also watched Tales of Fame and Fate. It's a video on YouTube, which also gave a lot of information. But mainly, I did use Who Killed Bob Crane, The Final Close-Up. It's a book by John Hook. I listened to his interview on Most Notorious, and that was also very compelling. I mean, people who have gone out of their way to sort of investigate this story and write about it has really turned into a labor of love for everyone, because it's a lot of information. I think it's captured everyone just based on the unfortunate way, you know, his life ended. Any of those sources are great to listen to read, to catch up on. And hope you guys like part one and part two of the Bob Crane story.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Post Hogan's Heroes, and like you mentioned, a few other things after that, he did also have a hard time. I mean, Disney was where he did Super Dad. Mm-hmm. And when they caught wind, now again, his lifestyle wasn't secret. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and so that also needs to be said, that it was known in the industry, was known throughout agents, production companies. Again, like I said, Disney, they were not a fan.
Kind of like William Frawley's alcoholism.
Right. And so they, you know, you have to proceed with caution because you're doing family friendly television and movies.
He was
not a
Disney.
No.
Wasn't what they
figure.
Wanted.
No
figure. Exactly.
And so that's when he began doing dinner theaters, when he, you know, he would do performances at dinner theaters. And this is where he was doing that beginner's luck at the Windmill Dinner Theaters, which they had various theaters scattered throughout the country. If you want to just jump into Scottsdale, Arizona, that's where he was doing like a three-nighter the summer of 1978.
And you did a lot of looking in on the murder, so I'm going to let you discuss that. But before we get to that, I do also want to say that, so during this time, the very end of his life, we mentioned he was working on getting a divorce. Patty and him were in the process of divorcing, but according to his youngest son, Scott, they were trying to work it out. They were going to try to give it a second shot. They had had a very nice Father's Day just a little bit before this. Retrospect, that was what it looked like. Even looking at like his plan book, it mm-hmm. looked like he was, you know, they had set dates. They were trying to work things out. He also, at this point in his life, he was trying to better himself. And that meant, for one thing, talking to Reverend Beck. He is someone that he confided in and told, you know, he gave his confession basically. And he asked, you know, like, is this something that I should go seek help? You know, he was looking for basically a referral,
guidance.
Like
mm-hmm.
exactly. And he was willing to put in that work. And so at that time, you know, Reverend Beck was talking about how he saw someone that was just trying to get back on the right track.
Maybe broken.
And so you have to think, yeah, broken, but willing to put in the work. And you have to think, if he wasn't murdered right at the time he was, he might have beat this addiction. And then this would be a completely different story, right? Mm-hmm. He ended up dying while he was while he was struggling the most with it. Another part of trying to better himself was getting rid of, breaking ties with.
Yes, with Carpenter, with John Carpenter. Now, he did express it to his son. He was living with his son at the time, because as you mentioned, he was going through this divorce with Patty, or at least the separation into a divorce, and he was living with his son. And so he would express to his son that he needed to get rid of him, number one. Number two, he was getting kind of tired of him because it was kind of like a slow, long breakup, you know, that you're having a relationship with, even though it was just, you know, two guys who were friends. But he was so
Sometimes friendship breakups can be worse than real breakups.
That's true. And he was so codependent, Carpenter was, on Bob, that it was difficult, you know. And so that night, the 27th of June is, you know, the 28th of June was, he was staying at the Winfield Place condominiums. That's kind of the apartments that the theater had for him, because whenever he would do these performances, they always put him up, and they put him up at the Winfield Place condominiums in Scottsdale, Arizona. And of course, now what was different about this night was that Carpenter would always stay with him, literally in the rooms and the hotels and the motels and the condominiums, because of course they would all get the women, record, hang out together. I think he saw him more than he saw his own wives, really. And this time he had him like 30 seconds down the road. He put him in a separate location, and he was supposed to take him to the airport the next day. He even had that written down in his journal, because like you mentioned earlier, he wrote everything down. He journaled everything. He wrote his schedule, and on the schedule, you know, when they did find his body, was take John to the airport the next day, which was the 29th. Now, he called him the night before the 28th and kind of, again, did the whole breakup. I mean, again, he was always breaking up with him and like, I don't need you to come over. Now, the night before this call, or the night of this phone call, they were both trying to score with these two women. I mean, the addiction was still full on, even though he was trying to, you know, he was still doing the same MO. They met these women. These women kind of turned him down. And when Bob Crane got turned down, John Carpenter always got turned down. It wasn't like, okay, well, we don't have the star, we'll take you. It was, you know, so he was sort of, what's interesting is they were both maybe frustrated, more so John than Bob, because Bob went straight to his apartment to go to sleep, go to the play the next day. But Carpenter was very frustrated. And what's interesting is when I listened to the author of this book speak of, is if they both had their way with the women, perhaps none of this would have happened, because their mindset would have been different. The day would have gone smoothly. People would be in a better mood. Who knows? That did not happen. The women turned them down. And so John went to his place. Bob went to his. Then I think it was the very next morning where his co-star, Victoria Barry, was kind of surprised that he hadn't showed up to work just yet, which was unlike, you know, Bob Crane. So she went to his room to look for him. Now, he never left his doors unlocked. He was very notorious for, you know, safety and all of that. Plus, he was alone. So she knocked, she called his name, knocked again. And then somehow, maybe she pushed her way through, or, you know, she went through the back to look, and she went inside. The room was very dark. And so she assumed that perhaps he was in the swimming pool, something like that. She went over to his bedroom, and that's where she found his body. Now, what's interesting is that she thought it was a woman that was laying there, because if you've done any sort of research on this, you've seen the crime scene photos, it could look like hair across his face, but really it was streaks of blood from being bludgeoned. And he was obviously in his sleep, because his position was that of like a fetal position, like we were to, you know, sleep in bed with the covers over us, kind of in a fetal position. That's how he looked. He was in his boxers. Now, they're saying there's no way that, well, we'll get into it when it comes to suspects and things like that. So of course she freaks out, authorities come in and all of that. Now, while the police is there during this time in the mid-70s, they did not have a homicide division. So it was a, you know, small town, sort of bigger than they've handled sort of crime. So it was mishandled from jump. People were moving things around. People were able to take things kind of. And there was a detective that actually got onto the bed and shaved a part of his hair. Okay. Which is, what are we doing? You're contaminating it like crazy.
Yeah.
So he shaved a part of his head to kind of see what we were working with, which is something that, you know, a coroner does. Right, not a detective in the room.
In the scene. Yeah.
You're not going to do an autopsy while you're at the crime scene. So he did that when they noticed that it was, you know, it looked like it was either a golf club or a bat or something. It wasn't a punch. It was obviously a blunt object because you had the splatter behind him. Again, if you see the crime scene photos, it clearly was, you know, the blood was right behind him, on the walls, on the pillows. And what's interesting is that they found a sort of indentation of two marks on the side of his head and a cable wire around his neck. Again, we warned you, this is pretty gruesome. This is gruesome stuff, but this is how he was found. And the only thing that matched something like that would be a tripod. Now, he traveled with 2 to 3, you know, tripods wherever he went. He had a whole equipment, you know, baggage and things like that. And one of them was missing. And there was only one left on that night when they found his body. And it, to this day, it has never been found. And so they matched, you know, they even did like a recreation, and it shows that it would land perfectly if it was a tripod. So someone, whoever did this, took the tripod with him or her. And so they took his body. Now, during the time that people are scrambling in this room, again, contaminating it like crazy, it wasn't, nobody, you know, cut the room off. No one put tape around there. It was just walked on. And Carpenter started doing something that he never does, which is call. He was calling in the middle of this sort of investigation, which they found odd. And when he called the room, Victoria Berry picked up the phone, right? And the police were kind of like, you know, giving her signals of
don't say anything.
And he's like, hey, is Bob there? You know, which is odd, because in his book, it's like, you're supposed to be on your way to the airport with him. And so she's like, no, I haven't seen him. You know, we don't know, you know, where he's at. Okay, great. And then suddenly he also calls his son. So it's kind of one of the, which is odd, because he never calls Bob Crane's, Bob Jr. He called him, and the first Bob Jr.
Bobby.
Yeah. And so, you know, Bobby spoke to this author, and he told him they find that very strange, you know, asking if he knew where he was, when apparently, obviously, he was with you. So this is sort of the robber coming back to the scene of the crime sort of thing, telephonically, to figure out what people know, what people are doing.
Yes. And sorry, I just wanted to mention, there was another big thing. It's hard to keep it PG when it's around this, but they also did find a white substance on Bob Crane's thigh.
Yes.
When we get to suspects, they think that it might've been John Carpenter's. What happened though, was that I think it was a detective was just like, what does this tell us, that he got some last night and they just didn't do anything with it.
Right.
And I mean, I was like, whoa. Huge miss. I mean, that could have literally led you to the murderer. Right.
Now, during this time, DNA wasn't really a thing. There was matches for blood and things like that. But now when we talk about suspect, they said, well, it could have been the husband or boyfriend of a woman, because he left quite a bit of those, by the way, because he would, you know, be with married women, girls who had boyfriends, fiancés, whatever, and he would anger men, really. Partners of these women. And so they said, well, could very well be a husband or boyfriend of these women. Now they're saying there was no force entry. There was no, you know, nothing was roughed up, and it didn't look like there was any sort of struggle, any sort of fight. Nothing was broken, or, you know, he was asleep. Now, when you're asleep, you're comfortable with what's happening around you. And so it says it's either a woman that he was sleeping with, and he's comfortable enough to fall asleep, or he let in someone he knows. And the only person he knew during that time was John Carpenter. Because even though he was tired of him and trying to rid himself of him, he would still have let him in. And so what they found interesting is this, well, if it was a woman, because everything was always on film, or he was very vocal of it, he was notorious for sleeping in the nude. And so if it was a woman, you'd find his new body, but he was in boxer shorts, which means he may have stood up when someone knocked, opened the door, let him in, and now he's asleep in boxer shorts and comfortable enough to fall asleep if his his buddy was there, John Carpenter. And so those sort of things, to me, was never the suspect, a husband or a boyfriend of somebody.
No, it didn't seem like that.
And so also his son was also vocal about thinking that it could have been his stepmother.
Yes, because he mentions he went missing and surprise, surprise, they're trying to get back together. She surprises him on Father's Day. He thinks she's casing the joint. Now, I do want to mention that Bobby might have a little bit of anger towards her in general, because they ended up with all of Bob Crane's.
Yeah, she stood to gain everything from his death.
Correct. Also, stepmother. What I am having a very hard time, if you've seen any photos of her, I mean, she's a petite woman. I'm not saying that small women cannot be strong, but from what the autopsy report says is that he died on the first impact. The first blow to his head was enough to just kill him. And it just surprises me. I can't fathom her being able to come in there and use so much force to kill a full grown man
I'm of the understanding. I mean, I'm of the belief that it was Carpenter. But to your point though, if you've listened to enough true crime or seen enough true crime, is, you know, I do enjoy watching that or reading about it. The most petite of women I've seen pull off the most extreme things. So if you have enough vitriol, anger, frustration, and your perfect victim is asleep, I mean, that's, again, the most vulnerable position to be in. She could have done something like that. I am not of the belief that it was a stepmother. Now, she could have had somebody come in, because now here's where the investigation sort of, you know, takes different places, because later on we'll get into, they actually did try and prosecute John Carpenter, and there was a witness that they used that was a mover that said he had seen a man hanging out or going into that apartment that night. And when brought up on the stand, they said, "Is this the man that you saw?" He said, "No." But again, this mover was not a good witness, because he was a drunk. He was very unreliable. His story would change from time to time. So it wasn't exactly the best person to have up there, but just another wrinkle to throw into the investigation there, because they needed something. They needed something during this trial.
The name Richard Dawson keeps coming up.
Yeah, and there's a reason for it, because I'm looking right at it. Of course, the police suspected John Carpenter right away because of his affiliation, his friendship, and all of that. And they needed to do an interrogation, sort of an interview with him. He was staying at Richard Dawson's house, not with his girlfriend, where he usually was living. Some people think it's because he was trying to hide out for a bit, trying not to be found for a bit. Maybe his celebrity status would help him. But during the time that he had already headed back to LA. And he was, you know, at Richard Dawson's house. And also the lack of friendship between the two.
Yeah. So from what I can see, because I did a lot of research, and from what I can see is that what happened was that they weren't the best of friends, but it kind of spiraled, like the Lucy and Ethel feud that was never a feud.
The story is that he wanted to be the lead, Richard Dawson, and he felt that he should have been Hogan.
He did. He was a little bit resentful, I think, but he also mentioned that his audition was atrocious, and that if he had been put in the role of Hogan's Heroes, he would have done really bad. Dawson, I know, and they say, you know, he didn't attend the funeral, but he also didn't write a newspaper article for Schultz, who plays Schultz.
Okay.
So he just kind of is a bit aloof to everyone in the cast. They weren't, like you said, that they weren't a huge friends, but they were close enough that he was allowed to come and stay. Carpenter stayed there for two days, right?
Right.
So not that close. But they all did get together at one time. They were all friends for a while. I don't think that he would do that. So I want to say that because Richard Dawson also knew that Hogan, Bob Crane, got him the role on Family Feud.
Yes.
I mean, he knew that. And I just, things aside, like Bob to be like, you know what, give it to him, and for him to get so successful. I mean, I'm not saying that fixes everything, right? That they're just there at that point. It seems like maybe, okay, we're at a stable work associate friend, you know, just like existing. nothing more, nothing less. We just exist.
Yes.
And I think that's where it is. But I think that, you know, and so we're going to talk about this. The media really, really destroyed Bob Crane. They took little pieces of here and there and they just ran with it, right? It was said that when they were getting the information, they didn't want to interview anyone who had anything good to say about Bob Crane. Mm-hmm. And the whole cast, including Richard Dawson, made a pact that they would not say anything bad about Hogan. If you want to interview us, we can say, or about Bob Crane, sorry. And they're like, if you want to interview us, we can tell you about the good that he did, or we can tell you about what it was like acting with him. And they just didn't, they didn't want to hear it.
The stories were too salacious because, to pass up.
Because you want to tell this story of this crazed sex addict that, you know,
takes videos and things like that.
And that's why he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about the movie that was made.
You mean Autofocus?
Yes.
Yes. So that was with Greg Kinnear and Willem Dafoe. And Maria Bello is in this too.
Now you watched it.
I did. Right? I watched it last night. And I think when I first told you about it, you told me that you wondered if they would just focus a lot on the salaciousness of it and not so much give him his due. And yes, in fact, this wasn't a biography of let's tell you how great his life was, because otherwise it wouldn't make so much for a great Hollywood movie. So there was a lot of the salaciousness of his life, the private, you know, parts of his life. And also, you know, they touched on his murder at the very end, of course, but mainly it was about his secret life. We went through the radio. We went through the Hogan's Heroes, a little bit of it really, but the majority of it, I'd say, is touching on that secret life of his, which I think, I mean, if you're a believer of all things, he died the way he lived. The irony is not lost here that he, you know, perhaps it was a tripod that, you know, was the murder weapon, which was used to do all these sinful things. That's where the movie's focal point was for that reason. But you haven't seen it.
No. Did you like it?
I wouldn't say like. I thought it was interesting. I wouldn't say like.
As soon as I found out that there was a lawsuit against the movie, I didn't watch it. They said that he had enhancement surgery and was into things that he was not into. I won't say them here, but they said, you know, that they talk about that he's into things that he was not into. And they basically just, they really did focus on all of that.
Now, that part that Patty, you just mentioned did catch me off guard during the movie, because I've been reading and watching other news stories and that would be a thing. And it never, you know, never came across it.
Patty also spoke out, you know, she's like, this is outrageous. It's just a distortion of my husband's life. It did. It just focused on the dark side. Now, Paul Schrader, who was the producer, I believe, or the writer, I don't know. He was a big part of it. He said that the movie was not supposed to be a literal retelling of Bob Crane's life. Mm-hmm. He said, certainly when you create a fiction, you have to manipulate reality, he says. The problem when you do that with a real person is that then people who don't really know that, you know, this is fiction, right?
Well, we had this conversation with Being the Ricardos.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. So if you come at it as a person who has no idea, you take it as gospel and you think, wow, that's quite the story. This guy was awful.
I mean, wow, this is a story about Bob Crane and this is what I learned about him. Exactly. And then that's all you hear. Mm.
And that's the problem with the problem and the good things about Hollywood is that the reason that they're able to retain your attention is because they have to fluff it up. They take creative liberties, and that's why you sign away. Well, maybe not in this case because they were being sued, but this is why you have the ability to make these stories, because if you just do it like a documentary, then you're doing a documentary and it'd be boring for some people. And so to entertain, you have to show all these salacious parts, especially when it's so, oh my gosh, it's the gift kept on giving for a screenwriter for something like this.
Exactly.
And so, and on top of it, you have a murder by a potential guy who's interested. And it's just, it's a lot. And so you forget that he had a career and a whole soul and a whole life before that, because this is too good to pass up, because you wouldn't make a movie without it. It'd just be like, oh, let's just do a documentary on his career then.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
who don't cares even that he was in radio and right. that he volunteered? Like, we don't care about that. We want the tawdry details.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this wasn't, the movie was not called The Murder of Bob Crane, because otherwise it'd be like, okay, so he did radio, he did TV, but this is the investigation on his death. Mm-hmm. And which I would appreciate, because I like how you would investigate a death like that. But this movie was clearly had an agenda to show, if I hadn't done the, you know, other information that I picked up by people who actually studied this, I would think,
yeah, wow. Gosh, imagine you watch that and me say, wow, I really like this guy. Let's yeah. do a show on him. And you'd right. be like, wait, why?
I wouldn't want to do a show yeah. just based on this movie alone. But right. Yeah, so during the investigation, not just because your mind immediately wants to go to John Carpenter as being the obvious suspect, but circumstantial evidence was that he had a rental vehicle. Carpenter did. Now, this is not a small, tiny, you know, Honda Civic. These are like the big, huge Cadillacs back in the 70s. And there were witnesses who saw the car there. Now, could have just been there because he was his friend, or because he's the one who killed him. Inside the car, there was a bit of blood on the door. What they say is perhaps a bit of brain matter. The only Ray, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't have blood nor brain matter in my vehicle. So I think the only way that you would have something like that is perhaps if you did something like that, or you bled. And they're saying, well, now this goes into detective work. How does that happen? Even if you did commit the murder, how do you get splatter? Not like a handprint, but splatter. And they think that the reason that that happened is because he took the tripod with him, the murder weapon, threw it in the back, it hit the door or hit around the door, and there's your splatter.
Splattered up.
Yeah, now.
I do also want to mention that that planner, mm-hmm. you know, had his life. So this wasn't a spur of the moment breakup with John Carpenter. He had that written, drop him off at the airport. Mm-hmm. And from what I can see, the reports are that his name didn't appear ever again in that book. That was it. Like,
he was done.
He was done. And you could, like, you could see all of his other plans, his TV show, you know, all the things he had planned, and John Carpenter was not in there. So it wasn't like something that he was just, you
spur
know,
of the moment.
I'm spur done. Of the moment. Yeah. Okay, I'm done with you. This is something he had been planning for a long time. He knew that, you know, be able to, and that's a big thing with addiction, right? If you are trying to get over an addiction, you need to cut ties with the people that are feeding into your addiction, that are yeah. feeding that. Yeah. And that is and very much what did. He was doing, right? Like, he was feeding it. He was helping him get but going with him and
oh gosh,
partaking, yes. enjoying, right? Oh, like yeah. someone to feed off of this. And so,
he knew. The reality is, now, I don't know if he had never met John Carpenter, would he not have been a sex addict? I don't know. He perhaps would have
continued. He was already a sex
yeah,
addict.
Yeah.
So
what he did was supply a different avenue of the addiction. And so it became even more a snowball effect. And so, like you said, you have to cut off what is helping you supply the bad stuff, and the bad stuff being, you know, once he introduced him to this electronic thing he could do with it, just became a different addiction coupled with, it was a lot. He needed to get rid of him, but you're right. After that, he rid himself of him, or he wanted to. And
right.
in this blood splatter that we spoke of in the vehicle, they did of course test it. This is pre-DNA. And the only thing that was conclusive was that it was the rare blood type B positive, which Bob Crane was. That just,
why that was not enough evidence, I'm not sure.
But see, that just confirmed that it was the same blood type, but that could be anybody. You know, this is 1978. Now we move forward 16 years later to 1994. They do finally. Sorry, let me go back. When they were doing the interrogations and interviews of John Carpenter, I listened to some of them on YouTube, and he could not sound more guilty if he tried. You know, he did sound very dodgy, very like, wait a minute, are you suspecting me? That type of thing, right? So finally he stopped talking. He, you know, time moved on, and 16 years later in 1994, he finally was arrested. Now, 1994 was a big year for DNA cases because the OJ Simpson case was happening during this time. And, you know, they did run the sample of the blood, and they did bring all this circumstantial evidence and arrest him. He was acquitted because I saw the interview of the jury foreman years later, and he said, we all believe he did it. Now, this is very, again, very OJ-like. We all believe he did it, but we don't think that they proved it.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
It was very frustrating to think. Plus, the way the police handled this whole case was very atrocious. It was very atrocious. Yeah. And as much as they did not want to let him go, they did because they don't think that they were able to prove that it was him. Now, in the early 90s, they did check this DNA 3 times afterwards, and it was all inconclusive. It always came back inconclusive. 4 years later, after being acquitted, John Carpenter dies of a heart attack in 1998. So along with, I mean, not even Bob Crane knows who killed him, really. So along with his, you know, with his death goes his secret, if, you know, whatever happened that night. A lot of the information that I was getting was from this author, John Cook, who did do an interview as well with, and he has a whole website where it shows all the crime scene photos, all the room diagrams, the reenactments, and the interviews that he did. Now, he was able to have contacts in the Scottsdale Police Department, where we're talking maybe like 6 years ago, they still had some. I mean, the whole thing was closed anyway. The case was closed anyway. So, I mean, we don't know who did it. The guy was acquitted, so it's just cold. And so they still had a little bit of the blood DNA sample that they could do, but the brain matter, if you will, was lost. I mean, it was like 30 something years later, they didn't have that. What they want, they had one last chance to see if this was really Bob Crane's blood in this rented vehicle from 1978. So they had a news reporter, the author, jury foreman, Bob Crane Jr., the Bobby, and Steve Avila, which is the attorney for John Carpenter back in the day, all going to, like, I think it was Phoenix 10, and run this, you know, this whole release of information for this DNA test. And it came back not being Bob Crane's. And what's interesting is that it wasn't John Carpenter's, it was another man's. So everybody's like, what?
Maybe John Carpenter was a serial killer.
So what's interesting, well, there's that. Wow, you just opened up a whole can of worms. Now, what's interesting is while they did that live, you know, during a news report, you know, attorney Avila is like, okay, good. This clears my client's name. You know, this is what I wanted for his family, his widow, you know, and all of that. But the foreman, the DA, and the son, I'll say, well, we still think it was Carpenter. This does nothing to, you know, prove. And the son was like, okay, then it's my stepmother. That's it. Those are the only two people I have in my mind. And, you know, to this day, there are no answers, but it's just frustrating to know that you'll never know. There's nothing left to test.
Right.
Unless they drain a lake that was behind the condominiums and find that tripod. But are you really going to find something that many years later? And if you do,
what's left on it?
There's no fingerprints, there's nothing. So really, we will never know. We know, but we'll never know. Sad ending to a very promising and bright life that yes. didn't need to end that way. And perhaps, like correct. You mentioned, he was trying to get on that road to better, you know, himself, perhaps save his marriage, all the things.
Right.
And
it was
that was very his clear. Plan. It wasn't John's plan.
Yes. It was very clear to those around him that, you know, family, and we didn't touch on this, but even his children were like, he's a good dad.
They like, spoke, you know, very highly.
Very highly of him. He was very, he tried to be somehow with his hectic schedule. He was, you know, he was there for them. And, you know, he was the kind of person, and we didn't talk about this and we're wrapped being up here, but he was the kind of person, and it was said by many people, that liked everyone, even people that didn't like him. And they think that that might have been his downfall, was that he was just very open and very, he didn't turn people away. He didn't turn friendships away. He didn't. So like you were saying, if John Carpenter had come that night and was like, listen, I just need to stay here.
Let me
like,
just
I
crash
can
here.
Say, yeah, I can understand we're not friends. Just give me like one more night to crash. I don't know, whatever. He wouldn't have been like, no.
Yeah, he would have been
like, okay, come on in. Come on in and we'll talk about this in the morning. You know, like,
so the fact that there wasn't a struggle, you know, the it sort of throws out the theory of the jealous husband, jealous boyfriend, because you would come in, you know, guns a-blazing and upset if you're in, you tell somebody beat him up or something, but the guy was asleep. He was comfortable. So either someone snuck in, but they said there was no way to do it from the sliding window in the back because there was a tremendous amount of cables, tripods and equipment, and it was dark. So if someone were to sneak in there, you either trip over it, you make a bunch of noise, wake him up, and it's a whole thing. So someone had to come in through the front door. And the fact that Victoria Barry was able to come in through the front door tells you that it was unlocked or otherwise open. That's the only explanation, really.
This is just a case of, it is a cold case, but it's a case where the media got a hold of a bunch of information. And they just decided, they made up their minds that he was an awful person and they ran with that. And then what happened was that because the media ran with that as the leading story, that is who Bob Crane became, right? He became the addiction. He became this sex addict. He became all of these awful things. They either don't care to, or they don't understand that there was more to this man's life and to who this person was than just that part of his life. You know what I'm saying? So, and I think that that's just awful. Like, I can't imagine being part of his family and knowing all the amazing things,
the contributions,
everything that he did in his lifetime, and seeing that that is all that people are focusing on, you know? Yeah.
Well, and it's like you mentioned the movie that's very much where it focused on,
or
you
know, watch it to say how horrible it is.
Here we do honor the life of Bob Crane because he did have a life. He wasn't just his addiction. He was a fantastic actor. He had his flaws. We all have our flaws. And, you know, he did whatever his flaws were. He wasn't a criminal and he didn't deserve to die the way he did. Certainly. Sure. So with that, we do honor his life. We'll post some photos and videos and things like that of his life, of his career, and of, you know, all the different aspects that he is known for. And yeah, if you guys like these sort of stories, please let us know. This one was, I think this is a two-parter, if I'm not mistaken.
We're close to 2 hours here. Yeah. So
with that,
if you find this interesting, if you guys have, we had a few suggestions. Mm-hmm. But if you have any more, let us know and we will start looking into those. So,
yeah, so
we did the two we wanted to do. So
our email is havingaballpod@gmail.com. And you can write us there. You can find us on Instagram, havingaballpod, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. Just send us an email or a message or a comment. We read everything and reply as soon as possible. So thanks, guys, for listening and let us know what you think.
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, guys.